Welcome to Cover to Cover. This is Richard A. Lupoff.
And I'm Richard Walensky, and our guest is Colleen McCullough, who is the author best known for her work, The Thorn Birds. Her latest novel is called Caesar's Women, and it's the fourth of a series of five novels on the Roman Republic. Before we get to Caesar's Women, I'd like to talk a little about The Thorn Birds and how it changed your life and how you came to write it. At the time, you were working as a medical research assistant at Yale University, is this correct?
I was a neurophysiologist and a research associate in the Department of Neurology at Yale, yes.
And how did you come to write an epic saga about Australia while you were working there?
I'd written Tim, my first novel, purely because I looked at the size of my paycheck, the fact I was a spinster, and that I would end up a 70-year-old spinster lady in a cold water walk-up flat with one 60-watt light bulb, unless I got off my duff and earned some extra money. And so I decided, since I'd written novels for my own amusement, since I was old enough to read, that I'd turn novelist in my spare time. Then Tim being a modest success and earning me some $50,000, which I thought was a fortune, I embarked on The Thorn Birds. This being an idea that I'd had since I was 18, when a friend of mine said to me, "You know, Cole, your family history is so fascinating, you really ought to write a book about it." So it was loosely based in family history. Because it was three times as long as Tim, I thought it had earned three times as much money. And never in my wildest dreams thought I had written a bestseller.
What happened? You finished the book and you submitted it to your agent, and then how did it work out? And at what point did you see that it was different from what you'd thought?
I sent it to my agent, who loved it. I remember vividly. "It opens like a flower," was how she put it. She sent it to my editor at Harper & Row, as it then was. Editor took a time, wasn't madly enthusiastic about it, because it was so different from Tim, you see. But I'd always vowed I'd never write the same book twice. Then somebody in the house got hold of it, I don't know who, and decided that it was something special. And it was submitted in manuscript for auction for the American paperback rights. The rights were sold on, I think it was February 28th of 1977, for a then world record figure, while the book was still in manuscript. Nobody had heard of me. It created a sensation, and I was famous overnight, having written a book nobody had yet read.
It came out as a hardback and jumped to number one immediately?
I have never before or since seen a publisher get a book out so fast. The rights were sold at the end of February. By the 1st of May, it was in the stores, in print. It just immediately went to number one. The orders were just phenomenal. It sold over 3 million copies in hardcover in the USA. Worldwide, you'd have to say that it was the second biggest selling book after Gone with the Wind. It's enormously popular. I mean, I've been groupied by Hindu girls.
Colleen McCullough, what were those earlier novels that you wrote before Tim, and have any of them seen light of print?
The earlier novels usually were whatever I had imitated or were in the style of whoever I had read that I admired. So, I mean, I wrote novels that were everything from Faulkner-esque to Heyer-esque. When Tim was published, I burned every single one of them because they weren't as good as Tim, except for one book. And I just thought, later on, maybe after I'm dead, people are going to fossick through my belongings and find these. I don't want them published. My estate, my heirs, whoever they might be greedier. and they might publish them in the off chance that one or two of them will make money. So I burned them, and they don't exist, except for one book. That book's still around. It was a novel based on the 10 years' war between Greece and Troy. I had read Mary Renault's The King Must Die at the time, and I wrote this when I was about 19, 20 years old. Never tried to get it published. It was something that I enjoyed, and that later on I thought, well, there was so much research went into it, I won't burn it. But I haven't contemplated having it published, because when you read it, it's not mature McCulloch. I think it'd make a great book for 13-year-olds.
Before you wrote your Roman books, you did write a book called A Creed for the Third Millennium. And after an indecent obsession, which in its own way could be seen as in the Thornbirds tradition, this was science fiction. You haven't tackled it before. You haven't tackled it since. Why did you write it?
Because it was time to write that book, I think. I don't see Indecent Obsession as anything like the Thornbirds, and it disappointed a lot of Thornbirds fans, because it's a book that deals with cruder and harsher emotions by far than Thornbirds. Creed for the Third Millennium began really when I had just married my husband. We were in New York. I'd just visited New Haven, Connecticut, to discover the whole of downtown New Haven boarded up because of the gas crisis. When I moved to New Haven beginning in 1967, heating oil was 9 cents a gallon. After the gas crisis of 74, it went up to $1.60 a gallon. And New Haven died. It's never recovered, even though heating oil is down somewhat in price from that. And I saw this whole town boarded up. And then I turned on the television in New York, and there was playing Jesus Christ Superstar. And the two things came together in my mind, and I wondered, how would a Christ-like figure get his message to the people 2,000 years exactly after the original Jesus Christ? That's why it's set in the future. I chose an ice age rather than a global warming, simply because I thought I could have more fun with an ice age. So it's not serious science fiction, but it's a very serious book, which has a lot to do with my feeling that organized religions, to some extent, benefit human beings, not God, and their main aim in life is to own property and earn money.
I'm Richard Walensky with Richard Lupoff. Dick.
Religion plays an important role in many of your books. Of course, the Thornbirds, the difficult theme of the sworn celibate falling in love. Do you have a personal, I won't say obsession, but fascination with religion?
I think fascination is a better word than obsession. Yes, I'm fascinated by it. I'm fascinated with what mugs people are. There's a good Australian word for you. It means fools. They get conned by religion, and sincerely conned. I'm not an agnostic. I'm not an atheist. I believe in the kind of God that I portray in Creed for the Third Millennium. Somebody who played around, fiddled with the universe, popped it into existence, and then just buzzed off and left us to it. And I'm always fascinated, though, but how man can take religion and organize it to suit his or her own purposes. More men have died, and women and children, in the name of God than in the name of anything else, including nationalism. I mean, all the wars lately, and if you were in Germany during World War I, God was on the Kaiser's side. If you were in Britain during World War I, God was on the King's side. World War II, the same. God was on the side of the Japanese Emperor. And so it goes. God's always on the side both of the loser and the victor. So you start to wonder, does the loser feel God let them down? Does the victor feel that they have been vindicated, in that God thinks, terrific, yeah, you're right.
Colleen McCullough, Caesar's Women is an historical novel. Yet in reading the book, even reading the epilogue in which you talk a little about the relationship of novel to nonfiction, it still strikes me that what you've written essentially is a nonfiction work, a history with invented dialogue to fill in some of the gaps.
Well, I stick absolutely religiously to history. But the problem with me is that I am a novelist and I love to climb inside their heads. When you write nonfiction, you can't climb inside your characters' heads. And it's always the characters, the people in all my novels who fascinate. Plot to me is a kind of byproduct. You've got to have one. It's what makes people tick. And I wanted to know for myself what made Marius tick, what made Sulla tick, what made Caesar and Pompey and Cicero, what made them tick. How did women feel? This being the one book in the series that I can devote plenty of wordage to women, simply because it takes place inside the city of Rome. And Roman women never travelled with their men. So that the other volumes in the series, you don't see a lot of the women. I try to bring them in where I can, but you never see a lot of them.
In reading this, and in your earlier books, it strikes me that one could argue that perhaps this book, because scholarship is greater now than it was, say, 100 years ago, may in fact be more of a history than the decline and fall of the Roman Empire.
Well, luckily I'm writing at a different period than Gibbon. But yes, prose becomes archaic and harder to stomach. And I'm already recommended reading in a lot of university history departments, chiefly because I do adhere to history and because I inspire the students with an interest and an enthusiasm that a lot of them don't get from the dryness of Roman Republican history, because as you taught it in university and high school, it's so dry. And the other thing is that these characters walk onto the stage of history as though they sprang fully armed from the brow of Zeus. I mean, I wanted to know what sort of child Caesar was. What were his parents like? What were his grandparents like? What kind of world shaped him? Because, okay, what you are genetically is one thing, but there's no doubt that your environment shapes you too. And to do that, that's why it became a series instead of one book, because I just got absolutely wrapped in the theme.
History, unlike a novel, doesn't really end. You could write these for the rest of your life and beyond.
Do you know, I get a lot of fan letters. And some people say, don't stop when Octavian gets the title of Augustus from the Senate. That's when I intend to stop in 27 BC. Keep on going. And one of my fans suggested that I should keep on going right through history to the present day. I would have to live to be extremely old. It will take me a decade from 1990 until 2000 to write 7 books, because that's how many it's going to take to tell the story of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic.
You spoke a moment ago of dry history. Why is history in school so dull while history in reality is so exciting?
I think the answer to that is very simply because there are so many lousy school teachers. I think that school teaching is one of those jobs that people go into very often without a true vocation. And history, if you've got a facility for remembering dates. I mean, to me, you know, if I was teaching the Battle of Waterloo, for instance, all you learn is that Wellington and Blücher of the Prussians beat Napoleon on the 15th of June, 1815, and you know from the poem about the fact that Wellington was at a ball in which the gay Gordons danced a Highland fling and then marched into battle. But you know, if I were teaching it, I'd be talking about the fact that right up until the end, Wellington never knew where the Blücher and the Prussians would get there. Napoleon had a horrendous cold plus a very severe case of the piles. It was soaking wet, and that was called Wellington weather. Napoleon's troops adored him, Wellington's loathed him, but they'd fight for him because they knew he won. And I would have gone on like that. And then I'd have got models and even Lego or kids' building blocks. And I'd have fought the battle. You don't have to have lots of toy soldiers to do that. You can do it with any kind of kids' building blocks. And I'd have had the kids there fighting the battle. They would never have forgotten Waterloo.
Colleen McCullough, Caesar's Women is long novel, 700 pages. The other ones are long novels. I would assume that the ones after that are long. There's a lot of research that goes into this. We were talking with a mystery writer by the name of Stephen Saylor not too long ago, who writes mystery set in ancient Rome. Are you familiar with his work?
Yes, I am, but it's a bit late period. And the trouble is that most of those mysteries are written in the Raymond Chandler vein. I'm the Agatha Christie vein. I don't like hoods who masquerade as detectives.
He's a scholar in Roman history. And I would assume at this point, so are you. What is your background in history?
My background in history is non-existent. I'm a scientist. But I do know how to do research. And, you know, that doesn't change. The discipline behind research, I proceeded with extremely perfect logic. When I decided on my period to try my historical novel, one of my bashes at different genres, I had the Cambridge Ancient History because I love to keep a very good reference library of all kinds. I went to Volume 9, which deals with the period between the Gracchi and the death of Caesar. It has a bibliography in the back about 3/4 inch thick. I Xeroxed it, blew it up so it was larger, then proceeded to acquire every bloody book in it. And then I looked at the bibliography of all those books, and my library ramified until I had some 3,000 books, by no means all of which are useful, but all of which I've read at least once. And I did the research at home by reading, 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 reading. And I now have a doctorate in letters because my research is so good. And as it was said, I've earned at least 27,000 PhDs.
A question about Caesar and the people around him that era. Was he the pivotal figure in the entire history of the Western world?
I think that's a good question because it's maybe on the lap of the gods. If he wasn't the pivotal figure, he was certainly one of them. But one wonders if Sulla hadn't marched on Rome, the first Roman ever to do so, would Caesar have marched on Rome? That's the big one. And I'm never sure whether Sulla's the pivotal figure or Caesar. Certainly one of the two of them. Because Caesar's great nephew Octavian could not have done what he did had he not had Caesar there as an example. But could Caesar have done what he did if he hadn't had Sulla there?
And could Sulla have done what he did if Marius had not come first?
Marius, of course, was the great iconoclast, the new man, the peasant. He tampered with the mos maiorum, or customs and traditions of Rome. But Marius could never have marched on Rome, and never would have, had Sulla not done it first, because Marius was a nobody. No, it's Sulla. Sulla was the great aristocrat, just like Caesar. I always see Marius Pompey as one half, and Sulla and Caesar as the other half. They were born to the purple, Sulla and Caesar. That's what made them so dangerous.
Speculation on your part. Let's suppose Caesar had not been assassinated. Where would he have gone?
Right where he was going 3 days later, into a five-year war in the east against the Parthians. He had no intention of being king of Rome. That's the bit that's always forgotten. He was bored to dry sobs with all this petty squabbling and whatever in Rome. The last thing he wanted was the death of his great enemies, because Caesar loved to run for his money. And I think that had he lived, he would have conquered the Parthians. He would have done all that Trajan had to do later. And he would probably have lived to be very old and, like Sulla, have laid down his dictatorship.
Therefore, had he lived and not been killed, the empire, if nothing else, would have been somewhat delayed. There wouldn't have been an emperor immediately. But I guess we can assume perhaps someone would have come along.
Oh, I think that old great nephew, he'd have just been somewhat older than he was when it happened, because I think that great nephew, Gaius Octavius, who became Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus and then Augustus, I don't think that fellow would have changed at all, and he would have been waiting in the wings for Caesar to die.
Was Caesar a genius?
Undoubtedly. We know that from the ancient sources. Words, when they wrote, were joined together. It was an endless line of squiggles. There was no way that anybody could read it at a glance. Caesar did when he was a child. That's first thing. Second, he was, quote, Hirtius in the 8th Book of Commentaries, the greatest engineer in the Roman army, one of the 5 greatest generals of all time. He was a poet and apparently wrote, unlike Cicero, formidable poetry. He was a playwright, a great orator, a fantastic legal draftsman, and a master politician. So you'd have to say the man was a genius.
I think in modern terms, and being an American, you have to forgive me for this, but here's where I was born and raised. I think of George Washington.
Do you know that you're not the first person to say that to me, and I can see it too, because Washington was a genius. There's no doubt of that. And I do see the resemblance, not between any politician on today's stage, but certainly between Caesar and Washington.
How did Julius Caesar become a god?
Julius Caesar became a god because it suited the Emperor Augustus to make him one. He was only 18, Octavianus, when Caesar died. He was lying on a beach in the western Macedonia town of Apollonia with his best friend Agrippa, who was the same age. When the news came that Caesar was dead, he immediately embarked for Italy and Rome. An amazing story, which I'll get to in, I hate to say it, there's going to be more than 5 books. But I think that at that age, that young man was both feral, brilliant, and probably very aware that the more he could, because he was Caesar's heir, extend Caesar's reputation into realms of the ether, the better it would be. So that was the start of Divus Iulius.
I keep hearing that you're talking about Stalin and Lenin.
Yes. Or Hitler and Himmler, maybe, or whatever. times don't change. People don't change. Caesar was very much more gifted than his great-nephew Octavian. But on the other hand, Octavian was a Julian. He had that blood. And I strongly suspect that on a memorable carriage ride from Spain to Rome, or at least from Spain to Marseille, or Massilia as it was then, when Caesar and his 16-year-old nephew shared the carriage, I think a lot of information was exchanged. And that's a carriage ride that nobody really has written about, but McCulloch intends to. I think politics then and politics now are related in that there's a little passage several pages long in Caesar's Women where I say what the candidate for office has to do in order to get elected. That hasn't changed a bit. You bribe the electorate still, but these days you do it with promises rather than hard cash. They used to do it with promises and hard cash back in Roman days because they liked to hedge their bets. There was no party politics then. It was factional. It formed around a man. And that still to some extent exists today in that the leader of a party still has to have a certain charisma that makes him and the party look good. The founding fathers of the US were steeped in the classics, and there is no doubt that the Republic of Rome was directly responsible for some of the aspects of the American Constitution, particularly the checks and balances, ditto law and commerce. So there are parallels, but I love it when people ask me, can you name somebody today who reminds you of Julius Caesar or Cicero or Clodius or anyone else? And I say, no.
Rome was not originally a republic at all. It was originally a kingdom which evolved into a republic and then back into an empire. How did Rome go from just crude village to kingdom and then to republic?
Rome is fascinating because it was just a little town on the Tiber on the Italian salt route. And they mined the salt from the marshes in Ostia, which is the port at the mouth of the Tiber. What it was about those soldier farmers that caused them to become undoubtedly the greatest people in the ancient world, nobody knows. We're all absolutely fascinated with. It was first a kingdom because I think that there was a lot of Etruscan influence, and they fought with other tribes in the area like the Volsci. It never occurred to anybody at that stage that something other than a kingdom could exist. So they were ruled by kings. But then, in an era really when democracy in Greece was just emerging, so that the democratic ideal certainly had not spread to Italy, particularly to the west coast of Italy. There were Greek settlements in the south of Italy, but not in Latium. They got fed up with kings because they got fed up with tyranny. And they threw the last king, Tarquinius Superbus, out. They did not kill him. And for many years after he was thrown out, he tried to usurp the throne again. The original Brutus was the one who threw him out. Brutus's sons tried to bring him back, and Brutus sat there while his sons were executed for treason.
And what year are we talking about now?
About 600 BC. The Republic evolved slowly with wars between the patricians and the plebs. Not plebs, but plebs, in which slowly the plebeians got the upper hand and were able to stand for high office. In the beginning of the Republic, only patricians, the original nobility, could. It worked beautifully so long as Rome had no empire. And Rome very reluctantly acquired an empire. mostly by going to war against Carthage, but that was because Carthage was usurping Roman trade routes. After they defeated Carthage, they inherited Sardinia, Corsica, Sicily, and Spain, as well as North Africa. And that meant all these places had to be controlled. Then they went to war against Perseus of Macedonia, and they acquired Macedonia and Greece. And then they were left other places in wills, like King Attalus of Pergamum left them Asia Minor. And Ptolemy in Cyrenaica left them Cyrenaica. And the problem with running a far-flung empire, particularly without the internal combustion or gas turbine engine, is that you can't do it as a democracy. And the democracy fell simply because the empire had grown too large.
We're talking on Cover to Cover with Colleen McCullough, whose latest novel is Caesar's Women. I have a couple of questions about material in other media. You seem to have had quite a bit of success. Tim was a very good movie, and Thornbirds was a wonderful miniseries. What do you think?
I think Tim was a nice movie. I think Thornbirds was absolutely bloody awful. I hated it. Filmed in California, totally un-Australian, left-hand drive cars, everybody with an American accent, and so it goes. And then Indecent Obsession was a movie too, and I thought it was okay, but not great. And they're going to make movies, some Italian companies, making a movie of the first man in Rome right now, or a mini-series, or a maxi-series, or something.
Well, I think as the author of The Thornbirds, given the differences between the book and the miniseries, sure, it was terrible, but as a miniseries unto itself, standing alone, it was fun.
You'll never get me to say that. I thought the script and the direction were just terrible. The acting in many places wasn't bad, but ask me why Rachel Ward played Maggie as a spiteful bitch, which is what she did, and that's a gross misinterpretation of character.
So you don't feel as if you've been particularly done right by Hollywood?
No, I haven't been done right by Hollywood. But Tim and Indecent Obsession were made by Australians. I don't think they... although Tim I liked. That's the only one I liked. But I don't think the Ozzers are any better. And being an expert at watching Roman movies, the Italian ones are just as ghastly as the Hollywood ones.
And what's the story? I've been seeing some promotional flashes on television lately for Thornbirds, The Lost Chapters.
Yes, well, there aren't any. That's the first thing.
Okay.
If you read the book, there's no missing years. That's what they're calling it. So it's not a prequel. It's not a sequel. I can only imagine it's an interquel. But it has nothing whatsoever to do with me. And I think it is going to be absolutely ghastly.
I'll have to watch.
I won't.
I have one final question. As I was looking through the glossary at the end, I noticed quite a bit about the Gracchi. And it called to mind a movie, Spartacus, and the character played by Charles Laughton. Now, Spartacus itself I found to be 50% marvelous, which was the Roman/English 50%, and 50% appalling, which was the American/slave part. What did you think of that? And what did you think of Charles Laughton in the role of Gracchus?
Well, it was so wrong, Spartacus the movie, for one thing because Kirk Douglas was far too old for the part, and it just seemed to me that, you know, athletes, you have to be not set in your bones. My Spartacus in Fortune's Favourites was 25, much more likely. He was a Roman. He had to have been a Roman. He could not have been a barbarian, or they'd have killed him for mutiny. The only people who survived to become gladiators after a mutiny were Romans. And to play, oh, dear, oh dear, to play Crassus as an effeminate git doesn't work, because Crassus was one of these people who just adored one thing, money. And I love Crassus. He's one of my favourite characters. And while he wasn't 100% admirable, I could never see him lusting after Tony Curtis.
What about my favourite, Charles Laughton as Gracchus?
Well, Charles Laughton's Charles Laughton. And I love Charles Laughton. I've always loved. Did you know that once they tried to make a movie of I, Claudius by Robert Graves? And I've seen Charles Laughton try to stammer his way through Claudius. It was never finished because he couldn't cope with it. But I don't care. I just love Laughton. And he made a terrific Captain Bligh too.
One final closing question. Colleen McCullough, you've got these books and you've got a few more there. Do you plan on writing anything other than Roman books?
Oh, yes. I've got heaps and heaps and heaps of ideas. I'd like to write a true science fiction novel. You see, I'm having a bash at every different genre. And I have to do a nasty novel about really nasty people. I mean, I love my nasty characters in books, but the book doesn't consist of nasties. I want to write one that consists of nasties. And then I want to write one that's very tender and sympathetic towards old people, because old people are not the flavour of the month. And I got a few others. I mean, I'd like to read, and I've got my medical book. Novel. I mean, I've got to write a novel set in the medical school at dear old Chubb University.
We've been talking on Cover to Cover with Colleen McCullough, whose latest novel is Caesar's Women. I'm Richard Walensky with Richard Lupoff.